Oops. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, October 29th. I'm your humble host, PK, and I'm here Monday evenings, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern, on Third Stream View at bbsradio.com, Station 2. And I would like to thank the suits in the office, as I always do, for promoting free speech and First Amendment rights, individual rights, and free thought, free inquiry. And thank goodness for alternative media, which is not controlled by the usual statist, corporate, pro-Zionist media, the managed news media. And here on Third Stream View, we don't, we're not beholden to anyone. BBSradio.com, I have complete intellectual freedom here. I'm sure they would intervene if I was advocating harming other people or killing people, which doesn't happen here. But I have called for the trial and execution of certain politicians and bureaucrats. This evening I have a friend on. I'm having a guest. His name is Tom. And he's an engineer and a businessman, and he's just gotten back from about a month in Saudi Arabia on business. So since I talk about many different things on this show, geopolitics, history, economics, Israel, Zionism, both of which I slam very hard on, also the military-industrial complex, and these types of things, it'll be interesting to talk to my friend Tom about what he's been up to. He's been to Saudi before, and hopefully he'll be with us soon as the office is putting the call through. I'm looking at their notes now. Soon. It'd be S-O-O-N. They spelled it wrong. Month has gone fast. Halloween's coming up. And I think he's with us. Our guest is out there. My friend Tom, are you out there?
Hello, PK. Good evening.
Welcome to Third Stream View.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be participating.
Would you care for some tea or coffee?
I'm sorry?
Would you care for some tea or coffee?
Oh, delicious.
Well, it's self-service, so you're out of luck.
All right. I'll have to find some here.
Yes. Well, anyway, thank you for coming on the show. I know that you are sort of a world traveler, and you have an engineering background. You have an engineering degree, and you have an MBA in business, which enables you to do some interesting things. I just told my millions of listeners that you've gotten back from another business trip to Saudi Arabia.
That's right. So I've been out working for about 30 years. I've not done engineering for maybe, the past 25 years or so. So the last 25 have really been more on the business side of things. And I've worked in a bunch of different industries, most recently for a company. We built ships. We sold a couple ships to the Saudi Arabian border guard. So I was out there on a several-week visit concerning that matter.
Nice. Well, I'm not going to bring up any last names or I don't need to know the name of your company or where it's located. But
right.
So you were just there for a month and practically, and you've been there twice before.
Yeah, I've been there a few times. This is my third trip. I was there, like you said, about 5 weeks this time. And it's a very interesting country. It's a very interesting culture. And there are definitely, you know, a lot of differences with what we're used to over here in the United States.
Right, right. And you were on the eastern side of the country.
I was. I was outside a city called Dammam, D-A-M-M-A-M, on the Arabian Gulf, in a smaller city called Al-Khabar, K-H-A-B-A-R, Al-Khabar.
Al-Khabar. And you were next to Bahrain?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I flew in from, we left D.C. Company's actually located on the East Coast. We left Washington, D.C., flew into Kuwait. From Kuwait, we took another plane to Bahrain. And then from Bahrain, it was actually a fairly short drive, maybe just 30 miles. Bahrain is another country itself, right off the Saudi Arabia, connected by a very long bridge of about 20, 25 miles. So we drove across the bridge through the checkpoints there into Saudi Arabia. The trip took about 2 hours, even though it's maybe just 25, 30 miles because of the checkpoints and whatnot, you know, going across the country borders.
Have you been to Dubai?
I have been to Dubai. That's over in the United Arab Emirates, UAE.
Right.
And that is an
been
amazing
there, huh?
City. Yeah, it's a beautiful city, Dubai. You know, known for its wildly varying buildings, right? They set a goal, I was told, of having the biggest and best of everything on the building side. So they wanted the tallest building, the widest building, the building that angles the most, like, you know, the Tower of Pisa, Leaning Tower of Pisa. They have actually built a large skyscraper that angles out. So it's a very interesting country, and they definitely are a very wealthy country, UAE, and Dubai is a very wealthy city.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a place I'd like to go to. It doesn't have trouble with terrorism. It's very posh.
It's very westernized. Yeah, it's very westernized.
Yeah.
In fact, it would look like you're walking around any, you know, large metropolitan area, city in the U.S., really.
I saw an episode of it on 60 Minutes a couple years ago, and the head emir or whoever he is, he kind of goes around in a SUV, and nobody hassles him. It's it's an up and coming country. It's, you know, very posh, but they don't, and they're right in the Persian Gulf, and they don't have any trouble really with terrorism.
It's really a country that was formed by several kingdoms uniting, hence the name United Arab Emirates, but it's a country that is quite westernized in terms of the culture. Women are allowed to drive, and they're allowed to vote, and they're allowed to work, and they can be uncovered. It's quite a westernized city, and the water is beautiful and warm. The beaches are beautiful, and very wealthy country. Interesting quick point about United Arab Emirates. About 85% of the population are non-Emirati. So there are folks there, perhaps from India or Pakistan or the United States or the UK, and they're there. 85% of the population is there on work visas. So
right.
15% are Emiratis.
I know that. They're very wealthy, and they're able to import all their labor, pretty much.
Yep.
Which
yep.
is not a bad thing.
No, not a bad thing. You've got the resources to do it, and people are happy to go there and make more money than they would otherwise. So.
Now, I know in countries outside of Saudi, like, you know, France and Britain, there's a lot of controversy about the burqa. And I, you know, personally don't care for it. But I was wondering about, as far as America goes, would the burqa be appropriate for, say, ugly women?
I don't think it's appropriate for any.
Why not,
person,
you know, put the ugly bitches
woman
in one of those? Would that be all right then? Would that work?
I would say no. I'd say who could judge who's attractive or less than attractive? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and I would err on the side that everyone is beautiful and nobody should be covered up. That would be my stance. It is something that's very important to countries for religious purposes. They believe. In fact, just a very quick comment on that. You know, I was talking to a Saudi gentleman there, and we're friends about that, because it is very striking when you see all the women, basically covered, completely covered, with the exception of a small opening, for their eyes in a black garment. Particularly when you think of Saudi with the very hot sun, which really is the case. It was 100 degrees when I was out there, about 37 degrees centigrade. And they said, well, they view their women like crystal, precious crystal, and they want to protect them. They don't want people seeing them. You know, they think their women are beautiful. They don't want other men seeing them. They don't want them being hassled in public. In fact, they don't even need to drive. They can, go wherever they want to go. They just tell their husband where they want to go, and they get taken there. They can buy what they want, and they don't have to deal with people staring at them. So, for them, it's very important. For me, it was very, very different. But you respect other people's cultures, and at the same time, I'm quite happy that I live in America.
Well, I've been to Morocco several times, and I've seen some of that there, the full garb. But, however, Morocco is a more of a liberal Muslim country where there's alcohol, and there's Jews living there and some Christians. But some women still choose to dress that way.
Yeah, that's true. And, you bring up another good point, which I didn't mention. Saudi is, an alcohol-free country, right? So there's no alcohol there either. And culturally, it's quite stringent. I really saw very, very few women without the full burqa. The women I did see, still had their hair covered. Even Western women, out of respect. When they're visiting and they're at the mall or whatever, they're covered. And I think it's just a way of showing courtesy. They're a very modest people. And it's just a way of kind of respecting their culture, right? In fact, I did some running outside, and I was even told I should get some long sweatpants, which I did, which were black, by the way. I was out there running outside in long black sweatpants in 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So,
did that happen to stimulate any of the Saudi women who may have seen you running?
They don't make eye contact. There were quite a few women out there walking in the dress that we've been discussing with their husbands, who were dressed, very Western in shorts and T-shirts, but their wives were dressed just the way we've been describing. And they never would make eye contact, with me.
Wow. Seems like sometimes we would long for some of our Western women to have such discipline.
Yeah, well,
little joke
no
there.
Such luck.
Yeah, I know. Well, so I talk about this entity on the show from time to time, but you are pretty much have been several years out of your life employment wise. You are you serve the military industrial complex.
Yeah, I worked for part of that time, maybe of the 32 years or so I've been working out of college, maybe half a dozen years. Well, maybe 8 years I've been working for defense-type companies, defense contractors.
Right. And they, they are quite powerful. They have a huge budget, in totality. And so you're over there in Bahrain, or next to Bahrain. you know, Bahrain is quite an oppressive country, and that's home to the U.S. fleet, I think, is why, you know, the U.S. tolerates that dictatorship, because the U.S., the federal government, I'm always referring to, I don't like to say we or us or America. That, to me, is not clearly defining the situation. I like to say the federal government. So the federal government tends to prop up countries it likes and bomb the ones it doesn't like, things like that. And Bahrain is quite repressive. They had a revolt last year or 2 years ago, and it was kind of put down rather quickly. But that is the home of the Fifth Fleet out there, isn't it? Or isn't there a big U.S. fleet out there in Bahrain?
And I really do not know, you know, in terms of the how much American presence is there. I know that they're, you know, a friend, as are the Saudis, and I know that there's a lot of resources that are acquired by the Saudis, you know, military and otherwise, from the United States because of the relationship. And they are both, you know, countries that are somewhat repressive, I think, of other people. I mean, that might be a Western view. I don't know that the, you know, Bahrainis or the Saudis would say that. But there have been uprisings, and the social media has played a big part in those things being organized, whether it's Facebook or Twitter. And there was just an article in the New York Times about, I mean, just within the last week, in the middle end of October, about the important role Twitter played and is playing with the many women there that are starting to want to buck the rules that currently apply to them. So you don't hear a lot about it, and it does become quelled and squashed fairly quickly. But there is that percentage of the population that is starting to question, you know,
in Bahrain or Saudi?
In both countries, actually, in both, and they were both squelched very quickly. In fact, when I was there just a few weeks ago, the Saudis sent military personnel across the bridge to Bahrain to assist in quelling what was perceived as starting to be some disorder, where people were beginning to assemble, and that was squelched very quickly, in part with support from the Saudi military.
Of course, and you know, and especially support from the U.S. federal government, because they it's the hypocrisy of the federal government. You know, Bahrain is quite a repressive, you know, dictatorship. I mean, Saudi's a thinly veiled dictatorship. Saudi got its name change, I think, in the late 1920, when T.E. Lawrence was there. I believe it was called Arabia, but then the big family, wealthy Saudi family, Ibn Saud, I believe, gave the name, because it became Saudi Arabia. And it's a thinly veiled dictatorship, actually. And, you know, big friends of the U.S. and the Bushes and the Rockefellers and all that big money, that big oil, big oil stuff. So, but Bahrain is just like they're buddies with the Saudis, the satellite. They've got I don't know if they have an emir or a king or whatever, but I know he's quite repressive.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
Yeah, and they put down
a... quite similar to Saudi, yeah.
They put down an uprising. So an uprising in Saudi or Bahrain is bad, but Egypt, Libya, Syria, that's okay. Because I get into global stuff here. So the military-industrial complex is very powerful. It's got a massive budget, you know, and most of it, you know, is at the tax trough. And it promotes, well, in the U.S. foreign policy, it seems to promote more wars and intervention abroad. And, you know, selling all these munitions and whatnot. But I would contend that this massive military-industrial complex is also sucking valuable, precious investment capital away from other private sector means and needs. But the federal government has put, for example, the company you work for, and a lot of companies in the defense industry, in the military-industrial complex – are situated, spread out through the states, so that the politicians in states like to bring, you know, money to their district for defense. So it's kind of a self-serving, self-thriving entity that really grew after the Second World War, as I understand it.
Yeah, that's exactly true, and I believe that's a good summary of where we are. So you've got these defense contractors, like any companies, and they employ X number of people, whether that's a small subcontractor or a large defense contractor, and they vote, and the politicians want to continue the work because that provides jobs and revenue to the area. So it is a cycle that everybody has an interest in continuing. And sometimes it's done right to the point where it doesn't it may not make sense to an outside objective third party, right? Where you're building things that maybe don't need to be built, or you're paying too much for things.
Especially ships and planes.
I'm sorry?
Especially ships and planes, and there's still a bit of this mentality, it's a World War II mentality. But here is the mighty PK knows. Nowadays, and for quite some time now, $1 million rocket can easily take out a $5 billion ship. And I do not believe that, you know, that their missile defense systems will knock everyone out, because it only takes one.
Right.
And that is not to say a submarine can't.
You bring up a good point. I mean, the technology is changing so much. Look at just in the last 10 years, how much has changed because of unmanned technology. You know, but yet there's, you know, the investment and the funding rounds and the allocations are, you know, sometimes take decades and decades to turn around. And you know, there's such a vested interest in funding, whatever technology, was in use decades ago. But today that may have been completely displaced by something that's considerably less expensive and doesn't even involve, manpower operating it. So
right.
It's very, very difficult to make these changes. This stuff gets put into place and there's parties that want to keep everything going and oftentimes they want more and they want bigger and spend more money, but technology is changing the game. You don't necessarily need more. You know, it's different. And in fact, it may be cheaper.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's elements of that, but in a more basic sense, you know, the Constitution calls for a military and a defense. I get that. We get that. But it doesn't call for an empire and having like 1,000 military bases in over 140 foreign countries. And, you know, World War II has been over for 67 years. The Korean War has been over for 59 years. So we would ask, you know, why are we still defending our rich allies then who hammer us on trade? You know, South Korea, Japan, Western Europe, it's ridiculous to have bases. You know, staff it with their own peeps, you know. So I would say that the military and the wars, the military-industrial complex is further bankrupting the country. And what should have happened, like after the fall of the Soviet Union in 91, I would think is that there would have been – of course we'd keep some industries for defense. We get that. But there should have been like a retooling for more – you know, consumer goods and private sector needs instead of fueling a massive military-industrial complex, because outside this country, and I understand why the world really resents the U.S. for attacking all these countries, bombing this, all the drones. And when I first heard about those drones, man, I knew they were coming to America. I knew they'd have me. And now every police station wants them. So that's not a future I look forward to. I just don't like what's happening. You know,
I actually don't know, I'm not, backing off the topic here. I really just don't know a lot about it. You know, I'm really just kind of looking
right.
At things like an observer, well, anybody would. But, I don't disagree. I do understand sort of instinctively why, this stuff takes a long time to change, because you've got all these, vested interests and parties and, they want more of what they've been getting, and it takes years and years and years for things to change. You know, that's why we're where we are today. But that's just, human nature.
Well, but, yeah,
I do believe things are changing.
they're changing. I don't think they're changing for the better. I mean, you know, Obama signed the largest military budget ever, and Romney, you know, if he had a chance, he wants to increase the military budget by like another $2 trillion over the next 8 or 10 years. I mean, Those of us who study economics and who are pro liberty, pro gun, pro defense, we just think it's ridiculous. That's a problem, and it feeds on itself. So I don't know how long you'll still be in it. I know you, like everybody else, you need a good job, but with your background, I would think that it would enable you to do, you know, many different things. A bachelor's in engineering, right, and a master's in business. That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I think I've done a lot of different things, and again, you know, being on the defense side has really been the minority of my time. It's happened to be, you know, where I am now. Sort of, I mean, categorically, you know, we're not selling weapon systems or anything, but
right.
We are providing stuff for for patrol, small boats for patrol. It's interesting.
Do you go out on those
boats?
It has
given me the opportunity to travel. I'm sorry?
You go out on those boats?
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah, I do have occasion to go out all the time, you know. And it's quite interesting. And you know, they're very important when they're needed. I mean, so far they've really just been doing kind of patrolling, and they're involved in a lot of search and rescue. They're involved in a lot of emergency response use. And when necessary, you know, they can be involved in an intervention to stop, bad guys from going where they shouldn't be going, maybe to a, you know, water desalination plant or something. You know, they want to protect the areas there and the facilities that are on the border. These are the boats
right.
that they use to scoot around to do that. So,
interestingly enough, you're still a scuba diver, aren't you?
You know, I learned how to dive a long time ago when it was $20, and then it only took four lessons.
Wow.
And I've been diving, you know, off and on ever since. I've been diving for a long time.
The Mighty PK here has been certified for about 25 years now, and I've dove a lot. It's been a while since I've dove, but I'm pretty good at it. And ironically enough, but of course, you were on the other side of Saudi, but there's very good diving in the Red Sea there, that what's that area called? Sharm el Sheikh or something like that. It's supposed to be excellent visibility, really good diving.
Further
between Egypt and Sinai, up in that area, somewhere like that.
Right. Yeah. I've not been in the water over there, but I'm sure it is. Great. I mean, the water is, you know, beautiful and very clear. You know, on the east side of Saudi, where I was, you know, outside Dammam, on the Arabian Gulf there. But I've not been in that water either. You know, I've been on the water. I've not been in the water.
So, how does the here at home, where you're glad to still live and be from? What does the economy look like for you? I mean, are you optimistic about the future, or do you see, you know, I'm very pessimistic about things. Do you see it getting better?
Well, I mean, just if you're talking about the U.S., I mean, I always kind of go back to basics, right? And for me, that's an underlying belief in the American spirit, in, you know, American ingenuity, in American work ethic, and I believe things are getting better. I think we've had a, you know, very tough 4 years. I actually think the president has done a good job. He's had many, many challenges, and he's accomplished a good number of things. There's certainly more than I think everybody, you know, would have liked to have had happen. But I do realize that, you know, things take time to get into these bad situations, and they take some time to get out. So I am optimistic about the future. You know, there's been just tremendous change in the last, you know, decade in terms of technology with Google and Apple and, you know, the valuation of companies like Facebook. There's innovation that doesn't stop. And I just think we need to, you know, continue pressing with our education and with our technology and, you know, keeping our borders open to you know, people that want to be here and want to contribute.
Well, yeah, I get that point. I get that. I understand that, the technology innovation. But I think the unemployment numbers are much higher than they're telling us. I think I don't see it getting better. I think it's stalling or getting worse. And
yeah.
And I don't like either. I don't like Romney. I don't like Obama. I'm not going to vote for either one of them. They both serve the war parties, you know, and they support the Patriot Act and a lot of things that I think are anti individual rights and civil liberties. But I just don't. I don't see the. I think we're stuck in neutral, and a lot of these jobs aren't coming back. And you know, a lot of these jobs are for the, you know, a lot of the blue collar folks and the, you know, the ones that don't have college degrees. And I think, I don't know, I'm not optimistic about the future, and it's because of my understanding of economics and, you know, the way things are changing. I think it's China's century too. They're having their problems, but you know, I think that's where it's sort of headed. Asia's, you know, coming into being, and you know, your kids' generation are saddled with massive debt that they didn't run up. You know, so I worry about those things, and I also worry about the collapse of the dollar or the fact that there could be things that we haven't really had in this country. I fear civil war between the haves and the have-nots. And a lot of the have-nots are just regular working-class people who would otherwise be, you know, perfectly law-abiding. And I also fear food riots. And I'm not
things are definitely tough for a lot of people. And I've been there myself on a few occasions, you know, without work for extended periods of time. You know, several months at a time, on a few occasions. It's very, very tough. It's very tough. And my heart goes out to anybody that's going through that. And there's millions of people going through struggles to one degree or another. And it's very difficult. There's a lot of fundamental changes, I believe, that are occurring. And, you know, whenever there's big change like that, there's people that are you know, kind of stuck in the middle, trying to, you know, make the change. You know, be a part of the change. So it's definitely not easy. And there's things we certainly could be doing better as a country to you know, facilitate these changes that people have to go through. But I don't disagree. It's difficult for a lot of folks right now.
Well, so as an engineering degree and a business person, I know you might look at things differently. The economy. I mean, do you ever ask yourself how would you fix things? What would you do?
Well, that's a great question. Rightly or wrongly, I would go back to the basics. You know, I would really stress education. I'd really stress lifelong learning, and I would stress training and you know, retraining for folks that are in industries or disciplines that are in decline. It's difficult for people to do because, you know, it's hard to learn new skill sets. But I've had to do that several times, you know, honestly, and it's kind of like going back to, you know, near zero again. But you know, I've had to do it, and I'll probably have to do it again. I think that's going to be a norm in the future. You know, my generation saw, you know, things change from the expectation of getting out of college, going to work for a company, working hard, and advancing and then retiring, you know, within that company or maybe with, you know, one or two other companies.
Right.
And, you know, in the 32 years I've been working, I have probably had, and this is not an exaggeration because I've counted them up, I've had 16 different jobs. And some of those were just companies I went to work for that went away. Some of them were a result of companies that were acquired. Some were a result of my losing my job. So I've definitely bounced around, and I understand hard times, and I also understand the importance of taking responsibility for yourself and your own well-being and affecting change, you know, and just pushing through. And it's very hard. And, you know, and again, I go back to what I said, we need to do a better job about helping people and, you know, being supportive and facilitating that change. I don't think we're always, the country's very good at doing that necessarily. We're a country of, pioneers, and a lot of it's left to people to do it like autonomously, you know, on their own, and it's tough. There's no well-worn path. So everybody's out there scrambling, trying to do the best they can.
Right. Well, I understand what you're saying, but because I'm in I have a strong background in economics.
Yep.
You didn't give me any information about how you would fix things about besides, people need to be educated and retrained. But what are the mechanics that got us into this mess? And
well, I think it was sitting on our laurels, to be honest with you, at an individual level, right? And I'll include myself in that, and then on a national level, right, where the country was not making investments in technology, in research. It was not, making investments in education. It was not...
I think you're getting colder.
It was not,
you're getting
laws
colder.
Or incentives for companies to, to reinvest. When we were heading in towards this the big recession, after 9/11, the word came out, go shopping. And I'm being somewhat facetious because I know there was a lot more than that. But
well, that was dumb advice,
everything,
too.
I'm sorry?
That was dumb advice, too. I agree with you about America's resting on its laurels. They think, oh, because we're Americans, everything's going to be fine. But it's like the guy that said, when we were kids, parents used to say, eat everything on your plate. You know, there's children starving in Africa or other countries. Now it's you better study hard because people in India and Africa and other countries, they want these jobs.
Yeah, and technology has allowed people to contribute, without regard for distance, right? I mean, I had some personal work on some consulting stuff I was doing, and I hired a young man in India, and who I've never met, and another young man in the Philippines who I've never met, and they're doing work for just several dollars an hour. It would be $30 an hour over here, so, and it's all done remotely, just with emails and sending things
sure.
back and forth, and they've done good work. So, it's a very competitive world. Technology has leveled the playing field, right? It's all, Thomas Friedman's, the world is flat stuff, which I, I'm experiencing and believe that to be the case.
I like some of what he has to say. But you're going off sort of in a tangent, not really tangent, but my point is that, yes, the research and technology, that's continued. But what got us into this mess, which most people don't understand, is and most people blame the bankers, and rightly so, but they were enabled by the Federal Reserve. So that really has nothing to do with education or technology or innovation. It's the banking system that caused this mess. And if interest rates were even back in 2001, if interest rates were 6, 7, 8%, we wouldn't be in this mess we're in now. It's lowering the interest rates caused a huge credit expansion. And the people who get the new money first spend it before prices rise, like defense contractors, welfare recipients, construction, the construction industry. So this is an inherent structural, it's an inherent structural problem of the federal government that caused this problem. See, that's how we look at it. We are followers of Ron Paul and Austrian school economics. And these other things you mentioned are important, but the main problem is central banking, creating trillions of dollars out of thin air backed by nothing. And, you know, putting the war on China, credit card with China. You know, this country has massive debt. And like Ron Paul says, it can't be sustained. There's going to be a reckoning day. So,
yep.
I just want you to know that.
I don't disagree that the banking was a big part in the crisis we're under. You know, and I, by the way, I was there in New York when the towers were hit, so I saw the impact. You know, that had on the economy. That was huge. There are a lot of contributing factors, and you know, I guess I kind of approach things in terms of what I can control. You know, not able to really control or influence all the banking stuff, not even sure I even understand it really. So I kind of go back to the, you know, what I am familiar with and what is within my kind of realm, which is education, which is, you know, basically effort and continually trying. But certainly you're right, you know, those things all played a part in where we are.
Yeah.
You know, just getting back to the point about resting on our laurels, you know, I remember when the Japanese cars were first coming out, like the Hondas, and they were, you know, you would joke about something being...
Of course we joked about it.
...poor because it was made in Japan. That was the big joke. And even when the Hondas came out, they were like little toy cars. Nobody ever thought, you know, they just thought it was America's, you know, divine intervention. We were always going to be superior. Nobody would... You know, could make a car that would compete with Detroit, and again, that speaks to resting on our laurels. You know, and over the decades, things profoundly changed. So, you know, what comes to mind is, you know, Steve Jobs commented in his Stanford commencement address, right, when he said, you know, his advice to the class as he was closing out was, you know, stay hungry, stay foolish, and I
exactly
think we need to stay hungry.
Well, that's why. And of course, now China is the new Japan in a sense, but China's producing goods at a higher quality than Japan because they're starting later in the game, but they're already starting with better technology and you know, a historically higher level of innovation and technology because it's already there for them to take it further.
But what I really resent,
and I'm thankful to live here and proud, but, you know, that's about where it ends. I don't gloat about it. Because we are resting on our laurels, and I really hate this. I despise this description of American exceptionalism. I think that is totally BS, because I back it up with this. Does America have the highest math and science scores? Do we make the best cars? Do we have the most oil? Do we have the best – the best electronics.
Does America?
Does America have a monopoly on hard work, innovation, education, and technology? I would say no.
No.
You know.
Right.
So, and since I, unlike most Americans, I actually know world geography and world history, I also know that a lot of Americans think the world revolves around them, and it's really changing because of foreign competition. Therefore,
right.
I am one of the few Americans who actually knows that the world knows more about America than America knows about the world, and even a lot about itself.
Right. Well, you know, that attitude, that very provincial attitude about – and, you know, I love America. I think it's the greatest place in the world, but I don't think it's great without work, you know. But that a lot of people, I think, turned a blind eye towards reality in terms of, you know, where we're ranking or where we're slipping, and they just, again, I think it's just divine intervention. America's great, and it's always going to be the best. You know, and that's not necessarily the case. There's a lot of things we need to do. We need to do better, and you know, and it's a country founded on change and founded on striving and founded on, you know, struggle and strife. And I mean, that's what made the country great. You know, that's what made the country free. But you don't stay that way. You don't stay great unless you continue doing great things. And, you know, I think it's beholden on each and every one of us to do the best we can for ourselves and our families and you know, without sounding too aggrandizing, for our country.
Right. Well, there's a lot that needs fixing, and the worst we can do, one of the worst things we can do is rest on our laurels and think, because we're Americans, everything's going to be fine. This massive debt could get even worse, and I don't know if America will ever recover like people say it will, because there's a lot of foreign competition. Things are changing. I think the best thing we can do is, you know, lead by example, bring our military home so we have more wealth to put back into the country instead of, you know, propping up our rich allies. And
that's been another massive, massive expense and a massive drain.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
In years. Untold, unbelievable.
And no wonder these other countries are pissed off, because they're sick of America bombing them. They're sick of all these bases in other countries. Like, you know, Ron Paul says, how would America like it if we had foreign bases in our country, or Russian and Chinese bases in Canada and Mexico? You know, we wouldn't like it either. But we're not taught to think that way. Then Americans are astonished when they find out people hate us or attack us. Well, but it's been because of what the federal government's been stirring up overseas. I believe that the federal government is the enemy, because the capitals of our states, they cannot declare war on other countries. They cannot station troops overseas. You know, so it's the federal government, and the states made the federal government. It wasn't the other way around, but the feds have seized all the power. So that's where I see things getting worse, and not for the good of the country. And as a self-taught free market economist, I have this overview of the world, where that's where I'm coming from. Where you, as an engineer and a business person, I understand where you're coming from. I also think that a lot of businessmen, especially the Romneys and the Trumps and that crowd, a lot of big businessmen do not know or understand nearly enough about economics, especially free market economics, because they advocate and lobby for things that are not capitalistic.
Yeah, I would agree with that. they have been successful by, typically by starting businesses and growing companies that were, you know, profitable and benefited them and the other, you know.
That's not a bad thing, but then a lot of them went for political
thing,
favors.
They just may not have the macroeconomic experience either.
Well, yeah, but a lot of them, a lot of them then later on, they got political pull, like the James Taggarts, where they used politics and political privilege to rise instead of, you know, competition and innovation and hard work. They sought political privilege.
Sought advantage whatever manner would most benefit them, absolutely.
Well, yeah, well, you turned me on to Atlas Shrugged, and you've seen, you saw part one. So, you know, Dagny's brother, James Taggart, he's a perfect example of those corporate slime balls who, you know, she was a much better example of the market, not him. And that's what I see too many men, business people going into that direction. Well, listen, Tom, thank you for coming on to Third Stream View. I've kept you long enough. I'm going to wind down here myself. Appreciate your insights on things. It's interesting to speak to people that have traveled. I usually, outside of the country, I usually relate better to people who have traveled outside of the country, because they get it about a lot of different things.
Well, I want to thank you for the chance to participate. It's really great. I really enjoyed talking with you, and always find the conversations of great interest and very, very stimulating. So thank you.
You're welcome. It is an honor to speak with the mighty PK. We'll talk to you later, sir. Good night.
All right, PK. Good night. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. So, and I forgot to mention earlier, as I like to do of late, and that is to say to all those government pricks who might be listening, from the CIA to the FBI to the NSA, all these other Americans who like to oppress other Americans, screw you. Because now, and has been, well, pretty much for 11 years now, 9/11 has been an excuse to grow state power, to grow state control, to everybody's a terrorist, this awful TSA, thousands of sexual aggressors, or thousands of stupid a-holes, as I like to say. So, yeah, that's the Republicans for you. They failed so miserably on 9/11 that they gave themselves a $40 billion raise by creating the Department of Homeland Security. And which includes the TSA. Now everybody's suspect and everybody's a terrorist. And now all the police departments want drones. So it has really turned into a, what do they call it? A, well, besides a police state, what was that other term? Yes, thank you. That too. So that's why I like alternative radio and BBS radio, because alternative radio, even though the damn feds would like to regulate and intervene in this, and that's what I tell liberals. I mean, we don't have to intervene in the economy for so much regulation, even for health and safety, because markets and insurance companies regulate themselves. If you don't want the airwaves to be censored and the internet and to be shut down at a whim, you should also look at other things in the same way that you don't want the state and government heavily involved in that either. Now, for true cases of fraud and corruption, that's why we have local courts and pollution. That's why we have tort laws. We don't need a massive central state always coming to our aid. And it's, you know, it's funny how liberals, even conservatives, but especially liberals, or actually all governments, you know, they favor and they march to a further centralization of power and control and central planning. I mean, war is socialistic central planning. Look at the drug war. It's, you know, massive federal government intervention. And look what the feds do. In spite of that Obama-appointed prick, Eric Holder, you said they're going to back off on, you know, persecuting and prosecuting the, you know, clinical marijuana dispensaries, for example, in California, maybe even Colorado. They're still harassing these people, picking on them, shutting them down, harassing local law enforcement. You know, if I was local law enforcement, I would tell my dispensaries in my areas, look, if the feds come into town and they harass you, contact me immediately, because I would arrest those bastards and throw them in jail and confront the federal government to do something about it. That needs to happen. If I was a sheriff, I would gladly do it. I'd say, screw you, Uncle Sam. I'm the law around here. We don't need you interfering. And I would love to cause a confrontation. Although the spineless governor of my state, whatever state it was, would probably try to intervene. But, you know, that's what has to happen, especially nullification of practically all federal law. That's a good way to do it. So when I saw the the Libertarian debate last week, and they were asked – there was a debate last – was it Wednesday? I forget what day it was. Maybe it was Wednesday, where they had the four of the other parties debated, they were all asked, Gary Johnson, my choice for president of the Libertarian Party, they were all asked if they could enact any legislation, what would it be? And nobody brought up what I thought was the most important one, which is fully informed juries, because with fully informed juries, that means that jurors have to know their rights, that they can judge the laws, they can get rid of, they can nullify bad law. They might not be able to get rid of it, but they can refuse to convict, which is very important. And believe me, this is not going to happen in cases of rape or armed robbery or kidnapping or murder, things like that. This is mainly for victimless crime laws, especially, for example, the stupid drug laws or prostitution or gambling or even gun possession, these stupid other gun laws they're throwing up, you know. So fully informed juries can refuse to convict. And as long as you have a jury system with that, which I think government would be hard to get rid of, they'd face a major backlash. Fully informed juries would be very good to have, because – everybody should be taught about them in high school and college and know their rights as jurors, that they can judge the law, and they should be told by all judges about this. But the damn judges and lawyers, a lot of them are opposed to this, and, you know, they don't want people to know about this. But meanwhile, you know, and that's the other scary thing, you know, if we weren't allowed to vote our conscience or vote what's right, then they could merely use a computer instead of a jury. You know, so to me, fully informed juries would be the most important thing, because it could overrule so much bad law. It would just be great in that instance. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I've wound down my time here, and the mighty PK here is going to bid you all good night. See you next week. I hear my fans speaking. I'm here every Monday evening, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern, here at Third Stream View on VBS Radio Station 2. Good night, America and the world.